Today's program was brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, the brand new co-working space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, you're listening to Why Food. This is episode 3 of season 4 of Why Food, and I'm your co-host Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And we're here interviewing LaGaia Michan, who is the author of the Hungry City column in the New York Times. And LaGaia, would you describe yourself as a food critic, a restaurant reviewer? What title would you use?
I guess I don't usually think of myself with a title, but I think all of those apply.
Okay, great. And we're here to talk both about your personal journey to food, which is really interesting and funny, I think, but then also to talk about some bigger issues around appropriation and authenticity in food, especially in the New York City restaurant scene, which is something that we've all seen in various ways, and I think a lot of our listeners will be able to relate to some of the questions that we're talking about. So, LaGaia, welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We usually jump right in with an aha moment. I know you have a storied life before you came into food, but can you tell us about when you first had that moment where you said, okay, I know I want to go into food. This is something I feel passionately about. How did you start? Where did you go? Who did you talk to? What were you thinking?
I really should say that, to be honest, I'm a bit of an accidental food writer. you know, I didn't grow up eating amazing food. As I was telling Ethan before the podcast started, both of my parents grew up during the Second World War, my father in England and my mother in the Philippines. So they grew up on rations and canned goods, and I ate Spam, and I ate instant Simon, and I drank Tang. And we had mac and cheese out of a box that we spruced up with fried Spam and frozen peas. Mm. So this was my experience as a kid. And it's not that different, I guess, from a lot of Americans at that time, because fancier ingredients weren't really available. But I didn't have a family that was devoted to food as an art. And it was really only later in life when I met the man who became my husband. And he'd grown up in a single-parent household, and his mom was ill, and so he had been the cook. He taught himself to cook by watching cooking shows. And so for him, making food from scratch had special value, and that's something that I learned from him. And when I was working at The New Yorker as a copy editor, I was writing a lot of little book reviews, and I used to talk with the editor of the Tables for Two column, which was their restaurant review, and one day I just got to start writing for that column. And so I entered accidentally, but I've tried to be a really good student and learn a lot about food writing and about all the different cuisines I write about.
Are you ever nostalgic for the food that you grew up with? Do you make fried Spam with frozen peas for your daughter?
So good.
You know, I have not eaten Spam in years, but I remember the taste.
It's so good.
It's especially fried really crispy, and I think we used it kind of like prosciutto. It was a flavoring agent. So I do miss it. I just haven't. Yeah, I haven't eaten it in a long time, and I'm not sure it would be allowed in my house. My husband is the chef in our home, and so we eat a very high standard of food in the house, and so it might not be allowed.
Well, as you started into this kind of accidental journey, like, what were some of the big learnings when you first started writing kind of in a different way and also reviewing restaurants, just being able to interpret and look at and eat in this like more nuanced, or I don't know if you tell me if it's more nuanced, but having to know that you're going to write something about this later.
You know, I think I should say that sometimes my husband doesn't always like to come with me on my dining forays because he feels like you can't just relax. You have to pay attention to everything. You have to ask lots of questions. But over time, it's become more relaxing. I don't ask questions now when I'm there. Usually, I'll wait to talk to the chefs later. I'm much more comfortable with that happening on the back end and just kind of enjoying it in the moment. I think I've also had to learn a lot in terms of how to approach restaurants where it's a cuisine that's less familiar to me and to the readers. I think that early on, sometimes when I look back at some early reviews, I think, oh, I wouldn't write that way now. Perhaps mm-hmm. I made something sound more exotic than I should have, because just because it was unusual to me or to the people who I was dining with, it's not unusual for an entire group of people and a whole culture. And I feel like that's something I try to be very conscious of now. So that was something I
learned. How do you avoid doing that now? How do you, I mean, most of the restaurants that you're eating at are not food that you grew up with, are not cultures that you consider your own. So how do you translate those experiences, those, not just the food itself, but the whole restaurant, the vibe, the language that's being spoken, how do you translate that for an audience that isn't familiar with the food?
So I guess I try to think about when you're eating certain flavors or textures that are unfamiliar to me. And I try to understand the importance of that flavor or texture to that culture. So, for example, there might be a culture that really values meat that's a lot tougher, chewier than we are comfortable with in the West. And so I try to recognize that if I'm eating it, and perhaps it's not my thing, but I want to recognize that that's a texture that millions of people love. Mm-hmm. Same thing with sliminess or something that's mucilaginous. Or mm-hmm. These are textures that are beloved, and I want to respect that while at the same time letting readers know what what to expect.
What they're getting themselves into yeah. when they order the snails at the...
Yes. Yeah. But I think it's always a challenge. I don't know if I always meet the challenge, but I try.
Bouncing off that, how do you talk about like the educational component of your column, the educational component that certain restaurants, some have it or some care about, you know, being able to explain what their food is versus some of the restaurants are like, this is the food, this is written in the way it's always been written, there's no explanation. Like, what are your thoughts on, A, the restaurants, you know, is it their burden to do that? Is it your job to educate people, or is it really the onus of the guests themselves to learn that beforehand?
I mean, I definitely think that these restaurants don't, it's not their responsibility to teach us, and it's very kind of them when they do, when there's something on the menu that will give you a clue. There is something really fun about going to a place, and it's like an immersive language experience. You walk in, maybe the menu's not in English at all, and you really just have to gesture and kind of guess what you're getting, and that can be just great.
The best part of traveling.
Definitely. I think that I have to educate myself so much about each cuisine that I'm writing about. I don't know if I can say that. I don't know if I can put myself in a position to educate others. I can only share what I've learned. And that is, to me, the most interesting part of the job is just learning not only about these different dishes, but where they fall into a cultural, historical context. And then especially learning the stories of the people who are making the food, which I often find the most interesting part. I feel like I don't know if I could write 800 words just waxing, you know, lyrical about a taco. Yeah. But if I could find out why this person is making it, what's meaningful to them about making it in this particular way, then I feel like that's a story, and then that's interesting.
We had a question on Instagram. What are, speaking of what you like about your job, what are your favorite parts of being a restaurant reviewer?
I mean, I love finding all of these corners of New York that I might not otherwise have known about, you know, and because I travel all over and I go to all the different boroughs, and I just feel like I'm constantly learning. So that for me is definitely the best part of it.
How do you get leads on where to go? I'm sure a lot of people are curious. How do you take input? Do you kind of have your own secret like methods? What can you share with us?
Network of food spies.
Yeah.
Well, I would love to have a network of food spies. If anybody wants to send me tips, I am always open to it. I read a lot. I read a lot of blogs. I have never discovered a restaurant. I would never say that. Other people are always before me. The people who opened the restaurant, the people of their own, you know, neighborhood who came in first, and the people who so generously shared information of this restaurant's existence by either posting a picture on Instagram or writing a blog post about it. I'm very grateful to all of them. So I wish that I could just wander the city at all hours and find everything that was out there. Sometimes I think that this is a job best suited for someone really young, just out of college without a family, who could just, you know, roam at will. But I can't do that. So I do rely a lot on other sources. And then I'm lucky that I have friends who will just say, hey, there's this place and you've got to go.
When you're looking at whether it's someone you're reading a tip or you're reading someone else's tip to you, what is it that is especially compelling from all the different places you can go? Is it that there's a little bit of the story component already embedded in there, or is it the food looks a certain way, or like what really grabs your attention?
You know, I usually just up front, people just tell me to go to a place because the food is good. And if it's food that, it may be food that I've written about before, that doesn't disqualify it. I'm obviously most interested when it's a food that I've never had before. I think I kind of look at it to see, you know, is this a place that would otherwise not get any press? That's, I'm always curious about that. You know, all these little places, they don't have a PR department. they're not sending out press releases. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in the small places, the places that are maybe slightly uncomfortable, the places that aren't built for Instagram necessarily. But sometimes yes, it's that it's a particular food that I've just maybe never heard of, and I think that's a really interesting story in and of itself. And then I usually find the other story. Usually it's later. Sometimes when I do the research, and then I Googled very deep, like pages and pages, and then you'll suddenly discover that somebody, you know, there'll be a restaurant you're going to go to, and then you discover that somebody's made a video and they've interviewed the chef, but it's in another language because it's for a different audience. And I just think, wow, so there's so much here that I need to know more about.
I guess it's hard to separate your own identity from the conversations around food and food belonging to people of other identities that you're writing about. So how would you identify yourself, and can you tell us a little bit about how that played into your upbringing and your journey into food?
Well, I'm of mixed race. My father's an Englishman, and my mother's from the Philippines, and so I think that growing up, I thought that I was in the best position possible. I thought that everything in the world was available to me. I could take anything from Western tradition, anything from Eastern tradition. And then as I grew older, I started to see ways in which being of mixed race could mean you were excluded from both sides. Mm-hmm. You're not fully white, not fully Asian. But I think I still have in me this sense of going in between cultures, and not being anchored so deeply in one that I can't enter another, if that makes sense. But in terms of thinking about who gets to make what kind of food, is that kind of what we're talking about?
I guess, yeah. or who gets to write about who gets to make what yeah. kind of food, and who gets to read who gets to write about who gets to make, you know, yeah. like there's so many layers of...
Yeah. Who gets to opine.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, this is a big question. I think that this idea of being some kind of gatekeeper, I'm not entirely comfortable with that. I think of myself as, you know, in some ways, how lucky I am to have this job, how lucky I am to discover the things that I've discovered. I should say that when I first started writing about food for the Times, before it became the Hungry City column, I was just writing about cheaper restaurants. And then I would occasionally write about restaurants that weren't as cheap, but they didn't fall under a specific rubric. And even when the column started, I think that the idea first was that I would cover restaurants that the main critic wasn't reviewing. Mm-hmm. And some of them would be inexpensive, and some of them might just be, you know, slightly more expensive, but neighborhood places that would otherwise get ignored. And eventually, it became more specifically defined. And I think I now have this mission, which is to find restaurants in corners of the city that people might not otherwise know exist, that kind of speak to the fabric of New York City life, which is that we're made up of so many different cultures, people with so many different stories and backgrounds, and that's what makes this city great to me. So I feel like as soon as I had that mission, everything became clearer. I don't know if there's something specific to my background or if that I've earned this position in any way. I do think probably the bulk of the readership is white. But I guess I don't see myself as, I don't know, the idea of being being somehow a guide for white people into the world of immigrants, that doesn't make me totally comfortable. Mm-hmm. I'd first prefer to think of it as this is our city. I'm going to wander around. Come with me in a more general way. And I do feel a responsibility to the people and the restaurants I write about to be not to exoticize them and their experience. And I do have a duty to my readers, too, so that they know what to expect when they come to these places. So I just try to weigh those, too. I feel like I've gotten away from your original question.
No, I mean, I think that's fine. But it's a funny mission for a food column. Because in that mission that you just described, I don't know that you used the word food at all. And maybe you used the word restaurants. So if it's about finding cultures, finding populations or communities or whatever you want to call the ways that our city is fragmented and how difficult it is often for people to cross the lines, whether it's neighborhood or language or culture or whatever it is, people, I think just by the nature of life in New York City, you get very, you get locked into a pattern of movement, of the places you like to go, the subway that you take, the route you walk home.
Comfortable.
Yeah, exactly. And do you, I guess what I'm asking is, do you think that food is a particularly powerful way to pull people out of their normal routine? Or is food incidental and you're writing a column about the city that pushes people for other reasons?
No, I think that what you're saying is totally right, that food is a powerful way for getting people to step outside themselves, and so that people who might otherwise never have a specific interest in another culture or never have an opportunity to engage in them, suddenly this is a way. And it's also a way of entering places where you might not otherwise think you would be welcome. I mean, that's what's amazing, is that you go into these restaurants, and these are restaurants that often are they've been opened to serve a specific population, which probably a lot of the readers of the Times aren't part of that population. And this is a place where, yes, your difference will be noticed, but you're still welcome, and people will be willing, often, to show you their culture. I mean, thinking about this educational aspect, I don't think it's their responsibility, but restaurants are so kind.
Yeah,
They're so willing to also, you know, when you're stumbling efforts to try to pronounce the names of dishes or to ask questions. And I just think I've met a lot of generosity where people are really, they're just very open and willing to share something of themselves, even though you're the bumbling person who's coming off the streets.
So. Going off kind of through this topics of not exoticizing too much and not over-romanticizing as you're introducing or bringing people into this fray, like, what are some of the things that you are, like, is there certain things that you're wary of saying in your column specifically? Or is there, or things that you try to focus on to give a lend like a bigger perspective to your readers, if that makes sense, so that it doesn't feel like you're just pandering to this story or this culture. It's about specifically focusing on one person's story in that restaurant.
So, I mean, I will try to work in history to specific columns. When I wrote about a Bhutanese restaurant, I want to talk a little bit about the Bhutanese government and because it was just interesting to me, the specific philosophy that, you know, the king of Bhutan espouses. It seemed relevant to the story, or to talk about a lot of these restaurateurs or chefs they came to the United States as refugees, and how did that experience shape them? I'm struck again and again with how often these chefs and restaurateurs characterize themselves as being so lucky. Yeah. And I just think it's interesting at this political moment when immigration is such a big issue that I just have not come across any kind of animosity. There's just this sense of, I don't know. Again, it's this generosity of spirit of people just saying, how lucky we are. We're in the United States. This is fantastic. We get to make our food and share it with you. And you know, again, I want to be able to write about it in this way so it doesn't seem like I'm just holding these people up as exemplars. Look, good immigrants.
Yep.
Because that's not right either. So I listen and I try to tell their stories as specifically as possible. You know, why did you come over? What was your specific situation? What did these dishes mean for you? Where did they come from? How did you learn to cook? And there isn't always a deep story, or sometimes the language barrier is such that I can't get to it, in which case then I just have to do more research about the country of origin itself or about the cuisine. So every case is really different.
I know that you have a complicated relationship with the comments section on your on your articles, as I think many writers and journalists do. How do you, how do you sift through comments that might be sort of undereducated, or people haven't immersed themselves in this particular restaurant or the cuisine the way that you have, haven't read your piece in its entirety, and are jumping to conclusions? I don't know, how do you take their feedback or not?
Well, I stopped reading the comments last spring, and my life has been so much better since.
Was that decision? How did you decide to stop reading the comments?
Well, I realized that the comments were actually getting in the way, which is that I would read them and I would take them to heart. It wasn't simply that they would hurt my feelings, but I would kind of look at them and say, okay, what can I do better?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it made it harder to write in many ways, because I was thinking, trying to, you know, foretell what would be the negative comment. Should I really write in this way? And I just thought at a certain point, well, I obviously can't please everybody. There's just something about my style that is what it is. I can't change that. And I just have to always be thoughtful. So, you know, so occasionally people will then tell me about comments that people make. And I think, oh, well, what can I do? I think some people read the column purely because they're interested in food. And they aren't as interested in hearing the stories. And they perhaps only want to hear about the restaurants that are the best of their kind.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always the risk at whatever restaurant I write, if it's not, is it truly great? And for me, I can't hold every restaurant to that standard. I just wouldn't be able to write a column every week. Not every restaurant is great. Not every restaurant is consistently great, even if it's great once.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of restaurants are interesting. They might make one great dish and then a lot of mediocre ones. But it's that one dish might be enough, or there's something about the whole aura of the restaurant and the food that it's serving that strikes me as just being worthy of noticing at this moment. And so I have lots of different reasons why I write it, and I could see why somebody who purely wants to use it as a guide to where to go to eat could feel frustrated. And I acknowledge that, but I don't. I feel like with any reviewer or critic, you build a relationship over time. So when I read book reviews, I know who's writing it. I know whether I trust their opinion. I may enjoy the writing, but feel like I like different things from this writer. And that's just something. I've been writing the column for long enough that hopefully people know if they just hate me, I'm okay <Go ahead. laughs> with that. But maybe then don't read me anymore, because I don't want to just make you angry every week.
How would you say your style has evolved over the years? And when you look back and read some of your initial columns, do you think like, oh my God, or, you know, interesting, or just your reactions? And do you think that like your relationship with your readers has evolved in different ways across that time?
You know, I think that early on, I definitely wrote some reviews that when I look back now, I think I fell into the trap of maybe over-exoticizing certain things. Sometimes I look back and I think, wow, I used to really be able to write and now I'm terrible. but I think one thing, I think that I tell more stories about people now than I used to. That's definitely changed. One editor did say to me, he said, you know, the only way you're going to survive this job, just don't write about the food. Which is interesting, right? Because you have to write about the food. But what he meant was that was not the only thing. And when you write, you can write about the food by writing about other things. And that's guided me more and more. And part of that is simply because after so many years of writing about food, I've used up a lot of the words. I've used up a lot of the adjectives. And there's only so many ways you can say something is sweet or sour or bitter or the texture. And so that's the challenge every week, is finding new ways to describe the food. So if if I can spend a lot of time on the stuff around the food, but that still informs the food, then I'm going to be able to write it and meet my deadline.
Well, awesome. I think we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll be talking more about the changing landscape of the food and all the boroughs and recent adventures that you've had. So please stay with us.
Take a sip from your chalice just and I bow my head to you.
100 Bogart Street is finally open and ready for Bushwick. 100 Bogart is a brand new, state-of-the-art co-working space that provides turnkey workspaces, including open layout desks, meeting spaces, and furnished private offices. Members have access to top-notch amenities such as custom furniture, high-speed internet, spacious kitchenettes with coffee and tea, printers, scanners, and much more. Alongside their professional work environment, 100 Bogart also provides exclusive educational programming for any curious entrepreneur. Heritage Radio Network has made their new office home at 100 Bogart and will host many events there in the future. For more information about their co-working space, visit 100bogart.com and become a member to network, create, and educate.
Remember that time I came all the way out to Hoboken to prove my devotion to you. I know it will get easier over time.
Welcome back. I'm your co-host, Jenny Dorsey.
And I'm Ethan Frisch.
And here today we are with Lagaya Michan, the New York Times writer of A Hungry City. And we are so excited to have her because not only does she know all the good spots in town, but she's seen such interesting food culture evolve in New York City throughout the years. And we've just been kind of talking about how all of those has been played into her style of writing and how she also deals with commentary about that.
Yeah, can you maybe let's start with, I don't know, some recommendations, places you've eaten at recently that really blew you away, or I mean, I guess people could just read your column, but yeah, places you were surprised by recently.
You know, I think from last year there was a small Filipino place in I think it was East Williamsburg. No, it was in Bed-Stuy. It was in Bed-Stuy called Tama, and it surprised me because, you know, it's a place that it's not really a sit-down restaurant. There's no restroom. It's intended as a takeout place, but it was quite modern, and you get these bowls of biodegradable styrofoam bowls that are full of elegantly plated, artistically composed dishes, and it's Filipino food, but with a really modern angle. So that really surprised me, and I would recommend that people check that place out.
Tama, T-A-M-A.
T-A-M-A. I also really like the Amdo Kitchen Momo truck.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, in Jackson Heights. And I've only ever had their beef momos because that was all that was ever available on my visits. But that's worth a trip.
They have a much longer menu, but they never seem to have any of the other things.
I wanted to ask a little bit about gentrification and how you've seen that shape impact the different boroughs of New York throughout the years as you've been writing this column. You know, I'm sure we can have a very long conversation about the good and the bad of that. But specifically in terms of food, do you think that it's been helpful because it's allowed, you know, more people to come out and through different parts of Manhattan to outer boroughs and experience new things, or has been a problematic because of rent hikes or more things that I'm missing?
I think that the most interesting restaurants that I found are probably in less gentrified areas, because I feel like with gentrification there come a lot of French bistros and new American restaurants, and none of those are bad, but that's not the food I usually write about or that I'm interested in. It's usually slightly pricier food as well, you know. So I think what's interesting to me, the place that I just mentioned, Tama, it's interesting because you could see that as kind of a restaurant that's a takeout place. But there's something you could say, must have something to do with gentrification because it's more modern. It replaced kind of a fish fry joint with, you know, bulletproof glass and all of that. So you could say, and it still probably expensive for its neighborhood. So is that a sign of gentrification? But I find it an interesting sign, which mm-hmm. is that it's not gentrification because people have moved there who are looking for this kind of food. It's that here's a chef who needs a space that isn't that expensive. So that's what's interesting, is that I think chefs going out into neighborhoods where the rents are lower to open interesting places at a slightly lower price point. And I suppose gentrification will follow, and then there will be some negative effects of that. But I guess that's the part that I find interesting. The gentrifying just by itself, you know, I think I never review anything in Williamsburg because it's just not the kind of restaurant. It doesn't give rise to the kind of restaurants I'm interested in.
Absolutely.
One of the questions that came in through Instagram, but also something that we've talked a lot about, is authenticity in food and what that means and why we care so much about it. Even when we know we shouldn't, even when we know it doesn't really exist, there still seems to be this push towards authenticity. You want to go to a restaurant that feels more authentic, and I don't know that I can define, and I've never heard a good definition of what it means for a restaurant to feel authentic. It's like one of those things you know when you see. Mm. How do you factor that into your writing, into the choices about the restaurants that you're checking out, and the choices that you make at the restaurant, the dishes that you order?
So I think that I'm uncomfortable with the word authenticity. Yeah. Because it seems to suggest that there's one kind of preserved in amber mm-hmm. standard. And even if you go back to the country of origin, I think the food's going to be different at different places. There's no one way to make any of these dishes. So I'm most often interested in ways in which dishes change. So you come to a new country and suddenly there are different ingredients. And how do you adapt to that? And how do you also adapt to the fact that your palate may change, and by eating other kinds of food, and what do you take from the new culture that you're in and bring into your own? So I don't think that that's a. I just don't. I feel like you can say things like something's traditional, something's more modern, that there are bits and pieces, but I try never to use the word authentic. I think what people are looking for is some sense of something being true, sometimes I'll use the word true. Because something can be true in spirit mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that this is the way it was made in the home country. But it's true to the chef's memory. It's what they feel. It's the taste that they have in their minds. What I find interesting is that sometimes even talking to chefs, so I wrote a big piece earlier in the fall about Asian American chefs. And when I talked to different Asian American chefs, they all said, deliciousness comes first. That's what the most important thing, you know, that it was meaningful to them that if somebody who was an Asian made an Asian dish, that they had studied it, that they didn't just find a recipe on YouTube and knock it off. But they felt like what mattered was that it tasted good. You know, they said, well, it doesn't help if it's a recipe from grandma if you're not doing it well.
Yeah.
So... does that kind of answer?
Yeah, well, then how does that translate into the choices that you make about restaurants and the things that you order at the restaurant?
So I think that at a lot of restaurants, there will often be something that just, you know, that may just not seem right. You know, yeah. Something that seems like the compromise dish, the concession. I think early on, especially when I wrote about Thai restaurants, I would talk about certain restaurants not making any concessions to Western palates. And I'm not sure I'd use that language now. Mm-hmm. I was conscious of ways in which I felt like certain chefs of cuisines that are traditionally very hot would anticipate Westerners not liking that.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to think of it as, actually, that's, you know, they're being kind. You know, it's not like they're withholding something. they want to make sure that we have a good experience. They're concerned that we may not be able to handle it. And actually, even within their own culture, there are going to be people who don't like things as hot. You know, there is a range. So now we have this idea of people go in to a Thai restaurant and they say, we want it Thai hot. Not everything is supposed to be that hot, mm-hmm. even within that culture. So I think there's a lot of misunderstandings about what to... About what to look for. So when I go in, I'll try to do my research to see what are the dishes. If it's a particular regional restaurant, what should I order that would be most indicative? I'll ask at the rest, you know, what are the chef's favorite dishes? That's what I'd like to taste. And then sometimes the dish that doesn't seem as traditional might be the most interesting. Well, what's going on here? Why did they do that? What's the goal of this dish? sometimes a good story can come out of that.
So do you have any other tips for adventurous restaurant goers who walk into a place and want to figure out the best thing on the menu and aren't familiar with the cuisine? What should we do?
I think definitely doing research beforehand helps a lot.
Become familiar with the cuisine, yes. Number one.
Study it beforehand. Well, you can just really Google online just see what are the specialties of the region. You don't even necessarily need to know what they are, but you could. Sometimes if you're going to a restaurant that might have a menu in a different language, it might be helpful to learn the name in that language. Sometimes when I go to Chinese restaurants, I'll try to figure out what the Chinese name is because it might not be recognizable from the English, and I can't read the characters.
Oh, yeah.
But I think also when you're there, I mean, you can always ask. There's always, of course, the risk that when you ask, the dishes they bring you will be the dishes they think you would most like as opposed to what.
And then it's not authentic anymore.
Yeah. Well, they just might not be the best dishes.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so I think that.
Is there a question? Is there a way that you phrase that question to a waiter or a chef?
I'll sometimes ask what they like. I'll say, well, what are your favorites? This question doesn't always go over. I'm not saying this is a fail-safe approach. Yeah. It's often perplexing. No, as if no one's ever asked what do they like. Sometimes they'll often say, well, people really like these dishes. I've eaten a lot of this kind of food. I really like spicy food. You could try to present. I've had in almost lots of restaurants where the servers will say, It's really spicy. They always say, "Do you like spicy?" That's the most common question. Do you like spicy? But even then, you know, you have to be careful because you don't want to just have a lot of bravado. Uh-huh. And you don't want to end up with something that's inedible because they just put so many chilies in that you can't eat it. And that's not even the way. So I often will say, "Well, how would you eat it?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they still might say, "Like it's because then they'll say." I think I had at a Thai restaurant a server saying, I would go for a 6. Like they were talking about one range of 1 to 10. They were saying that was what they thought would be enough for that dish. So sometimes you're going to get, and sometimes it's just not going to work and they're going to serve you things and you'll think, I don't know what this stuff is. So it's always a risk and that's part of the fun.
Yeah. I had dinner recently at a restaurant that you reviewed, Playground in Jackson Heights, the Thai restaurant, and ordered the ant egg salad and got such a look of bewilderment from the waiter. Like, first of all, why was I ordering this? And second of all, did I know what I was getting myself into?
Ant eggs.
Right. And then I sort of responded to look, like, is that okay? Like, should I not be ordering it? And she said, well, I really don't like it. But
well, so that's interesting, actually. I think I ordered something there where the server looked at me and said, you know, it's really stinky. And I said, fantastic.
Yeah.
I love sticky. going off this topic of authenticity and what it means, what are your thoughts on, like, how there's this weird problem where, like, if you're an authentic small place and then you become really popular and you're able to expand and then you have 5 places, then somehow you're less authentic or people have this weird, there's this interesting dynamic that goes on. But, you know, at the same time, you want to support that place, you want them to be successful and make the money. So naturally, you want the press to allow them to garner more success and et cetera. Like, how do you deal with that since you also contribute to how much press they get and the enthusiasm around it? How do you keep up people's expectations as they continue to expand or not?
So it's interesting. I don't think any place I've written about for Hungry City has achieved this level of success. I mean, they're just starting from a difficult place. They're often in locations that people still find remote. Because even, you know, Sean Famous Foods, which is the kind of famous example of this kind of thing, that was reviewed, I think, by Sam Sifton. So it got the big review. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a whole different audience. Again, you know, I think a lot of the places I review, a lot of them will end up closing it, even though they get press, even though they get customers from me. It's no guarantee of success. But in terms of this larger question of, let's say, a very small place gets success, there's expansion, franchisement. I do think that it's interesting when we look at this question of what chefs are allowed to make a lot of money off of a cuisine.
Yes.
So there is that question, what chefs are allowed to charge a lot for their cuisine?
Who is allowed to charge? Yeah.
Who is allowed? But I also think then there are these other questions about who is able to get business loans and who is able to have access to certain kinds of, you know, real estate. So I think that it's just so complicated that for an immigrant chef, an immigrant chef is going to be looking at different kinds of spaces and me doing business in a really different way, and they're going to have a different kind of relationship with the press, and maybe not knowing how to get press, Western press. And one review does not build an entire empire in that sense. So I just feel like there are a lot of hurdles for the kinds of restaurants I look at that would make it difficult for them to do that. And that if they did expand, I think that would be great. You know, I do have some hesitation sometimes when I see, so I've gone to places where I do see certain cuisines where maybe it's the children of immigrants, so they've grown up in a slightly different way, and they're opening restaurants that you could see becoming franchises. And sometimes I've not been as thrilled by the food, not because it's not authentic, because it is authentic to them and their experience.
Right.
It hasn't been as, sometimes it's not as strong. Sometimes some of the stronger flavors. So I think when people talk about authenticity, sometimes there's this sense of everything's watered down, and then it becomes inauthentic, that it doesn't have those strong, sometimes uncomfortable flavors that, you know, it's not as smelly anymore, and it doesn't have that funk in it. And so when I eat food like that, sometimes I think something is definitely missing. There are contours that are missing, and just the food just isn't as interesting. It's not as delicious. But at the same time, I think how interesting that they're going to franchise this, and suddenly people all across America are going to be eating this kind of food that they would never have considered before. And there's something worthwhile. And there's even a possibility that maybe a cuisine has not really arrived until it's been dumbed down. And Americans recognize it in a dumbed down form. You know, I just wonder, because that's the journey of Chinese food in America. From the very beginning, Chinese chefs changed recipes to please white Americans.
Yep.
And like, the rest is history. It's an enormously successful cuisine. And then finally, you know, now we're finally getting a chance to see all the different regions and learn all what it, you know,
really,
it really should. I'm doing quotes here. Should taste like. But I think these are interesting. It's just interesting the way that cuisine evolves over time, and I'd love the fact that the halal guys are a franchise around across America. Aren't they?
Yeah, all yeah. A spot yeah. in Vegas. Or
I think
something.
They're in like Dubai or something.
It could be
something crazy.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Why not? And it's good. So
I used to line up for that. So you know.
And then to that question of appropriation, right? Chinese cuisine. If we stay in that topic, Chinese cuisine has I don't know if you would call it gotten to a point, but is at a point now where non-Chinese chefs are appropriating or selling Chinese recipes that maybe they learned after years of deep study in China, maybe not. Does that make their food less true? Does it make it less valuable? Does it change the way that we approach Chinese food cooked by Chinese chefs or Chinese American chefs?
I think, you know, these are all really interesting questions. So I know that when I see, if I see that a restaurant is open up that's serving, you know, it could be Mexican food, Chinese food, those seem to be the two cuisines that are most often taken on by white chefs. And often the story that goes with them is that these chefs have studied, you know, seriously, spent time in the country. If you look at somebody like Fuchsia Dunlop, she's a scholar. She's highly respected in China as well. And, you know, you look at somebody like Andy Ricker with Thai food, and Rick Bayless with Mexican food. So I think it kind of goes back to these questions of who has access to capital to open restaurants, who has access, you know, to real estate and to building, you know, media attention and all of this. So I think it's not that these chefs shouldn't be allowed to cook this food. I think that just makes the world more interesting, that everybody is, we want people to be going around and learning from each other, and it makes food more interesting when people do that. But I, you know, then the question is, should they not have the opportunity? But how do we make opportunities available for, you know, people of color, recent immigrants, children of immigrants, who just might not have the same structures in place to be able to get where those chefs can get?
Yeah, we talked over lunch before we started recording about the sort of savior motif or the outsider motif, making food a little bit more accessible to other outsiders. I'm an outsider to, I don't know, pick a cuisine, Bhutanese cuisine. And so by writing about it as an outsider, you make it more accessible for me. and I'm your reader, right? Like, I'm a white guy who grew up on the Upper West Side. If I don't read the New York Times, I don't know who does. Yeah, I don't know. Is that something you think about in your writing?
I mean, it has not been before. I think that I think ideally, I'm hoping everybody reads it. I really don't want to be writing just for a white audience, because I do think that people from all cultures can learn from each other, and it's not just one way. It's not just all white people come and learn from everybody else. But I suppose that from a practical perspective, that's what the readership of the New York Times is. I think I'm getting lost. Can you tell me back to your original question?
I think I'm lost also. I don't remember how we got to this. Something about appropriation. Jenny, do you want to save us from ourselves?
I mean, I think we're kind of just talking about the topic of, like, is it, if you are talking or have some sort of knowledge on a of a different culture, how do you approach it respectfully, mm-hmm. and how do you share with others in a fashion that shows that you do know what you're talking about, but it doesn't mean that you are the only person that knows what you're talking about. They should only listen to you. Yeah.
Right. So I hope that I try to be humble. I just feel like I'm always a student. I'm always learning, and I would imagine my readers are in the same position.
I think as a, I was gonna, when you were talking about just like chefs having access, I was thinking to myself in the interesting opposite problem. As an Asian American myself, a lot of times when people ask me what kind of food I cook, they, before I even open my mouth, they're like, Asian food, you know? And it's almost this, it's like a weird, the contrarian problem of like, well, I don't actually really cook Asian food.
And what is Asian food
what
anyway?
Does that mean? What kind of Asian am I?
Right? I mean, it's complicated, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, I think that, so I think also, obviously, chefs shouldn't feel like they only have to cook the food of their
exactly.
heritage. That's not fair either. So I think, you know, when I was talking to Asian American chefs back in the fall for this piece, you know, I thought about this issue of, and I remember this moment on, I don't remember which season of Top Chef it was, but there was a Vietnamese contestant, and as is often the trope for Asian Americans in all of reality TV,
yeah.
I could go on a whole tangent about this, but they're always, yeah, they're very much in their heads. It's cerebral. There's this image, the image of the inscrutable Oriental is live and well. And so I think this Vietnamese American chef, extremely talented, clearly technically outstripped everybody else in episode after episode. So of course they had to have a story for him. The story was, you know, you are inscrutable. We don't know what's going on. Where's the emotion? And finally, you know, one of the judges said, I don't know. I don't see you in your food. And what they meant by you is I don't see you, mm-hmm. the son of Vietnamese immigrants. I don't see that story in the food. And I think about this because we all love this story. We love the story of the chef who is cooking the food, of his or her childhood. And I write the stories of all of these people. So I'm always conscious of this because I know this is a really compelling narrative. And at the same time, a chef should be able to cook whatever he or she wants.
Yep.
So I don't really know how to solve this conundrum. I mean, a lot of the Asian American chefs I talked to, what they said is that initially they didn't want to cook that kind of food.
Yep.
And also, when they went to culinary school, almost no time was spent on any kind of Asian
Never.
Cuisine.
Yep.
So they were always taught European food's better. And I can remember specific chefs saying things, of being in class, and I think one chef had likened some French dish to a curry, and her teacher was outraged. That you make this comparison. So I think that a common story for these Asian American chefs was returning to the flavors that they loved after time away. So and that's a great story, but they could also have gone on and cooked anything else. And that's their, you know, everyone should be able to do that.
Yeah, that seems like a great note to wrap up the interview.
Thank you so much for being here. This has been such an incredible like hour or so of talking. Could you tell everyone a little bit about how to find you, how to get in contact with you, where to send restaurant tips?
Oh, my goodness. my column comes out every Wednesday in the newspaper. It usually goes online every Thursday, the Thursday before. And I'm on Twitter, but not really. So Instagram is a good place to find me. And I just say, you know, if you're going to go, if you want to just get started on finding cool restaurants, just go to Elmhurst, Queens and walk around.
What's your handle on Instagram?
Oh, I think it's just at Lagaya Michonne. I can't remember.
Okay. We'll tag you in some posts on the Y Food Instagram page and link to it on the on our website at heritageradionetwork.org.
Thank you all again for tuning in today, and thank you, Lagaya, for being here. If you have any additional questions, comments, feedback, please reach out to us at whyfood@heritageradio.org. And thank you again to our new theme song, Red Crickets, by...
No, the song is called Blind.
Blind by Red Crickets.
And the band is Red Crickets. I hope you like the new song. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I don't know how to take time when I'm still blind.